The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When it's time to create a website for whatever's newsworthy in your life, whether that's a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or just a blog, go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Around 100,000 people in the UK have multiple sclerosis, a devastating neurological condition which often starts when people are young and can cause long-term disability. There is no cure. New guidelines on the best way to diagnose and treat people with MS have just been published by NICE, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. While patient groups say there are good things in them, there is controversy too, particularly over the refusal of NICE to approve the cannabis-derived drug Sativex. People with MS have long said that using cannabis helps relieve their muscle spasms, and there is evidence that it works, but NICE says Sativex is too expensive, even though it has been approved in Wales. I'm Sarah Bosley, health editor of The Guardian, and to discuss this, I have with me an expert panel. I'll get them to introduce themselves.
Hello, I'm Dr. Paul Cooper. I'm a neurologist from Greater Manchester, and I chaired the group at NICE that developed this guideline.
Hello, I'm Professor Mark Baker. I'm the director of the Centre for Clinical Practice at NICE, and I'm responsible for the whole of the clinical guidelines programme.
And my name's Nick Riker, and I'm Director of Policy and Research for the Multiple Sclerosis Society.
My name's Amy Bowen. I'm Director of Service Development at the Multiple Sclerosis Trust.
This guidance is going to be very widely welcomed, I'm sure, by patients and by the doctors, people who treat them, the doctors who treat them. However, there are a couple of issues, and I think we might look at the issue of the cannabis-based drug Sativex to begin with. I understand that it's available in Wales, and yet the NICE guidance committee decided that it wasn't appropriate to have it approved in England. Could you tell me why that is?
You've already highlighted the positive benefits of this guideline, improving services. There are other aspects of the guideline, including an issue relating to a particular drug, a fairly costly drug with minimal benefits, small benefits. NICE looked at the evidence of benefit very carefully and compared the benefit with the costs. And we felt that that money could be better spent on other services to improve care in other ways. You've mentioned that Wales came to a different conclusion. We've asked Wales for details of how they came to that conclusion. I have to say we have some reservations about their analysis. I think they've been a little naive in some aspects of their analysis. They've taken information from the drug company at face value without seeing the original data. And they've used dosages and potential benefits that we would not agree with. We've gone back and looked at our calculations, and we remain of the view that this drug does not represent an effective use of NHS resources, which we feel we better spent on other areas where we know we can improve care.
Thank you, Paul. Mark, did you want to add to that?
This is an update of a guideline we first produced more than 11 years ago, and it's a very comprehensive overview of the management of multiple sclerosis. And one of the issues I think that has been overlooked is that there are a number of treatments now available for the management of spasm in multiple sclerosis, which is the area of the disease for which Sativex is licensed. And many of these treatments are not routinely available on the NHS when they should be. So I think those who are campaigning for the availability of Sativex are overlooking the benefits of other drugs which are cheaper and more cost effective. And there's only a very small number of people, I think, who will not respond usefully to these other treatments. And they may, in some cases, benefit from Sativex. But overall, in the doses described in trials and at the price required by the manufacturer, we don't regard Sativex as a sensible use of NHS resources.
Sounds like one of those very difficult decisions. Nick, what do people in the MS community think?
It's already been described that Sativex wouldn't be suitable for everyone, and we absolutely acknowledge that. The licence itself says that it's for people who are not responding to other treatment, and of those people who are then treated under that licence, roughly one in two benefit. And our own survey of people with MS who use Sativex 82% of those regard that treatment as essential or a high priority for them. So let's not think that for those people that it works for, that it doesn't make a dramatic difference to their quality of life, because it does. And so you then have the backdrop to this, which is that successive governments for nearly two decades have argued that people are not allowed to use cannabis, that there will be a medical product that's going to be created by the pharmaceutical industry. And when it is, and when it's licensed, it will be prescribed through the NHS. Well, we now have that treatment. It should be available through the NHS, but under this guideline, it just won't be.
Amy, have you had a strong reaction from the people that you represent?
Certainly, when you think about spasticity, which is actually the symptom that Sativex is licensed for treatment for, spasticity is a very, very common symptom in MS, and it's important to think about what the day-to-day impact of a symptom like that is for people. Spasticity is involuntary muscle stiffness. Muscles are very tight. It can be very painful. It has a huge impact on your ability to do some day-to-day tasks, and it does benefit from access to licensed therapies to help reduce that muscle stiffness and, as a consequence, reduce the pain and increase the mobility. And we are disappointed that Sativex hasn't been recommended under the guideline. But I think our deeper concern here is that the guideline itself is very focused on the range of different drug treatments for spasticity, but rather silent on the broader elements of service that you would expect to see to help people manage spasticity, educating people about their triggers and self-management of their triggers, the use of MS specialist nurses for education and for other interventions to help improve people's range of movement, involving OTs, occupational therapists, and physiotherapists. And we do feel overall that there's a fundamental problem in the guideline, that it is silent on a number of very important aspects of care that make for a well-rounded service. And our concern is that those things that aren't present in the guideline gives the message to commissioners and managers that those things don't matter. So we were really looking and expecting a guideline that was more comprehensive in terms of some of the issues that it raised about a rounded package of care for people living with spasticity and other very burdensome symptoms.
Right, we'll go back to those issues in just a minute with Paul, I think. But Mark, can I ask you first? It looks to me as if you may be in the headlines here over a postcode lottery, and it's likely that a lot of people will be saying this drug really works for us, and talking perhaps of selling their homes. We've had all those sort of issues in the past, or even seeking cannabis illegally. How do you deal with that sort of storm that breaks over something like this?
Well, we have applied our standard methodology to a common problem, and we've come up with a solution, which is that there are other treatments available which should be tried, and that use of Sativex is not cost effective. There's nothing in our guidance to suggest that people currently receiving it should have that treatment withdrawn, but we do not suggest that future patients should be offered it on the NHS. We don't think it's good value.
Right. And Paul, what do you think? Are you prepared to weather the storm on this one?
Well, you've alluded to this concept of a postcode lottery, and the MS Society has itself identified a significant postcode lottery in the provision of services for people with MS throughout England and Wales. And in their survey, which was carried out with the Royal College of Physicians in a validated form, a robust survey, they showed how poor services were nationwide. And we believe that our guideline will try and correct some of these inequalities in service. It's been suggested that we've not named particular professionals that might be involved, but what we have done is looked at the package of care that a patient with multiple sclerosis should be able to access without actually putting badges on the white coats, as it were. And we believe that it's more important to focus on the services and the care and the support and the information that an individual needs rather than the professional bodies that provide those services.
Nick, I think you think that this guidance is a really good thing, don't you, in principle?
Well, it's a mixed bag, is the answer to that. There are absolutely good things in it, and as Paul is talking about, some of the clinical practice recommendations are very good. We particularly like the endorsement of coordinated care. So people shouldn't have to kind of battle their way through the system to figure out who and what intervention might help them, and then work out how to actually get it. What NICE have recommended is that there should be care coordination, and there should be multidisciplinary care too, and we think that's very beneficial. Of course, there will need to be changes to make that pragmatic. In real life, there are NHS tariffs that stand in the way of multidisciplinary care. It costs trusts more to operate in the right way than it does in the wrong way. And so changes need to be made to make some of those good recommendations a reality.
Right. Amy, are you happy with the answers you heard from Paul just there? Well,
a few things. Just a point of clarification. I think the audit that you referred to, there was a survey and an audit. The audit that you referred to with the Royal College of Physicians was actually conducted by us, by the MS Trust, over intervals since the publication of the original guideline back in 2003. The MS Society published its own survey in the last couple of years, which is a separate issue. So just to clarify
that. Just to come back on that, you would not be surprised that even professionals involved in this area can be confused by these two organisations. And I think merging is long overdue. And if you were speaking as one, you'd have a louder voice.
That's very interesting. Are there any proposals for this?
There aren't any proposals for it, but we do work very hard so that we speak as one. I think the levels of cooperation between us, I would describe, certainly in the last kind of X years, are unprecedented, and we work together all the time.
Yeah, I think that's true. The MS Trust has a particular role as the principal provider of education and professional development for MS health professionals, particularly the MS specialist nurses and the allied health professionals, that's physiotherapists and occupational therapists, who have this expertise in MS, which the guideline does recognize and call for. And we do welcome that recognition and acknowledgement of the importance of the multidisciplinary team, and also the recommendation for an annual comprehensive review. We think that's a really positive step forward, and we do welcome that, as well as the recommendations around the provision of information, particularly at the time of diagnosis. So there are lots of things, as Nick says, that are to be welcomed. Our concern about it is about what isn't there. It's our the gaps that we feel are present in the guideline, and we understand some of the reasons why those gaps are there. But the fact of the matter is, if you're a manager or a commissioner, a payer or a provider of services, you look to something that holds itself out as a guideline for a comprehensive description of what constitutes best practice in care. And I think there's a gap. The guideline does fall short in our estimation in that respect. We think there's a big opportunity to correct some of that around the quality standards, which we know will follow on. That's the next step in the process. And we are very keen to work with NICE to try and raise the bar to the place where we think it needs to be to really give managers and commissioners what they need.
Mark, can you tell me perhaps, do you feel there are gaps in the guideline?
Well, there may well be. We don't pretend to cover everything in our guidelines. It would be impossible to do so. We'd never publish anything. I'd just like to clarify that quality standards are based on the content of our guidelines. It's not an opportunity to rewrite guidance.
Okay. Going back to Paul then. What about the gaps that it is alleged there are? Do you see that there are some, and in which case, why are they there?
There's a process in developing these guidelines. We proposed what we should cover. That was put out to public consultation. Organisations, including the MS Trust and the MS Society, were involved in that process and gave us guidance themselves as to what they felt was important early on. And we took a number of recommendations from a range of organisations and focused on what came through strongest as the areas that we felt we could best help. This is not going to be without cost. The services that we've proposed and the improvements that we've proposed will come with a cost. This is not should not be looked upon as a cost-cutting guideline. What we're proposing will have additional costs, as Nick has already suggested. And alongside the guideline, NICE will be in the process of developing what Mark has alluded to, which is the quality standards. And these have far more status in the commissioners, and hopefully will be helpful in discussions with commissioners as to which elements of the guideline are the most important and which ones they should commission.
Does this guideline have a cost, effectively? How much is it going to cost? Or, in fact, will the NHS implement it, do you think? Or, you know, do we need more doctors, for instance?
We don't need more doctors. Well, there's an element of the guideline relating to diagnosis which does impact on neurology services. The audit from the MS Trust suggested that that element was relatively small, but there is a potential cost implication. The biggest cost implication will be in improving services throughout England and Wales in a multidisciplinary manner. I can't today give you costings of that. There will be a process of implementation of the guideline that will involve some costing calculations, but I don't have those in front of me today.
One of the things the MS Society constantly hears from neurologists is really that they just don't have the time to offer patients the level of service they know they should. And if you look at the number of neurologists per the patient population, the UK has a pitiful number of neurologists. If you compare it to like countries like France or Germany or Spain or Italy, they have far more neurologists than we do for their patients. And so what we really want, we will need more neurologists if we're to achieve the levels of service that people need. And that comes through in all sorts of simple ways. So people's reviews currently tend to be incredibly short in most areas, often just 10 minutes. And how can you really go through the complexity of a condition like MS in 10 minutes? The truth is you can't. And so neurologists are forced to pick on a very kind of a light appraisal of how people are and how they're doing. And so for us really to achieve the level of sophistication that we need, we have to tackle that issue as well.
Do you think that we're not doing as well as other countries in that case?
Oh, we're not at all. I mean, you only have to look at comparators for things like disease-modifying treatment, and the UK languishes right down at the bottom of the league table for the whole of Europe, where I think we're 25th out of 27 countries.
To be specific, you're talking about drugs there?
I'm talking about drugs there, yes, but also if you look at access to a whole range of other services, the majority of people with MS are not having access to the services that could help them, and that's where this guideline needs to come in and needs to change the way that practice works. But that will have a cost if we're to achieve the kind of number of clinicians to patients that we ought to have.
Okay, Amy.
That extends beyond just the neurologists. I think the MS nurses and the allied health professionals, the physiotherapists and the occupational therapists are also absolutely pivotal to providing a comprehensive multidisciplinary service. And, the MS Trust works very closely with the MS nurses and are monitoring availability and provision of specialist nursing across the UK. And there are some significant areas of underprovision. And making sure that we have a clear definition of what expertise really means across all those disciplines. That goes for neurology as well as the allied health professions and nursing. So we have a clear understanding of what expertise really means. And then we set a standard about access and provision, and then be assiduous about making sure that that is consistently available across the UK. And that's going to be a concerted effort. Now, the guideline does offer us some very useful recommendations as a platform for working on that, but it will take some concerted effort on the part of the patient organizations to be advocating for that, and it will take some financial commitment on the part of the commissioners and providers to deliver that.
Okay. Mark?
I'd just like to clarify that the low take-up of disease-modifying therapies is not due to our guidance, which is generally supportive of their use, but it may be due to barriers put in the way of patients accessing them, such as a shortage of neurologists who can approve them, or indeed some commissioning rules agreed locally about how patients get access to drugs. This is something we hope that the new frameworks that we've described in the guideline will help to overcome.
Mm-hmm. And just to clarify, disease-modifying therapies simply improve people's symptoms, don't they?
No, these are the treatments that reduce the risk of progression in people with relapsing remitting disease in particular, which is the commonest type.
Thank you.
Can I just clarify that actually the disease-modifying therapies reduce the frequency and severity of relapses, and the hope is that they will have a long-term impact on disease progression, but that isn't absolutely conclusively proved yet in the data. There's a strong indication that that is the case, but getting people access to treatment and the option to get started early is increasingly the treatment paradigm now that we are all working toward. I wonder if I could pick up on one other thing that Paul mentioned about the guideline development process, because I think this is really important, and it may sound a little technical, but actually I think it's one of those areas about the way the guideline development process happens that has a lot of impact. So we were involved, you're right, we were involved in the scoping exercise, the MS Society and the MS Trust, and the scope was agreed, but then there's an additional step in the process where that scope is turned into a set of questions, and those questions are posed to this group, the guideline development group, and the task of the guideline development group is to answer the questions. What does the evidence say about this set of, in this case, 18 questions? So anything that's not contained within those 18 questions, the guideline development group has a very difficult time addressing itself to. So the nature of the process is such that the guideline group is sort of hamstrung in terms of getting across the full breadth of what they might want to address because they are constrained by the questions that have been posed to them. And I'd be really keen to understand more about how those that are responsible for the program think that that's really helping us to get at what is a comprehensive description of best practice in MS care.
So Mark? Guidelines are based on a review of the evidence. The questions are posed as quasi-research questions in order to know what to look for in the literature. We can't look for everything without some focus. So the process, which Paul started describing, was that we start with a scope which defines the area of the condition that we're interested in. That is then consulted on. And either before or after that consultation, we refine the clinical questions that will form the basis of the guideline. Now, as I've said, that may sometimes leave some gaps, but we can't cover everything. If we dealt with everything in a guideline on multiple sclerosis that every stakeholder wanted, we'd have to be updating it before we published it. It just takes too long. So we've had to be selective. If there are some important gaps, then we'll have a look at those when we next review the guideline, and we review it every 2 years now. So I'd be happy to hear from the charities here and other stakeholders about any important gaps in our guidance, and we'll look at them again.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we'll just finish by asking you whether you think that this guideline will improve things for people with MS who are, it is a neglected disease to some extent, isn't it? Can I ask you, Amy, first, and then we'll just go around the table?
I think there are opportunities for this guideline to make be the catalyst for some significant improvement in services if we are assiduous about its implementation. But I think we have to be equally vigilant about some of the gaps and omissions and be highlighting that there are areas of best practice which are not covered in the guideline and are critical to making sure people with MS get the care that they need.
Okay, Nick?
Absolutely agree with Amy that there are recommendations here about clinical practice that if they're implemented, which is a really big if because the last guideline was poorly implemented, if they're implemented will help and will make a good positive difference. Where there's a big negative, it is around the two medicines, Sativex, as you mentioned, the drug based on cannabis, and Famperidine. The negative recommendations on those will leave people for whom there are few other treatment options because they're licensed for people who for whom other treatments haven't worked. Those people will be left without a treatment option.
And Mark?
I think the guideline is paradigm shifting. It focuses on getting an expert diagnosis early and getting patients with newly diagnosed MS onto the full treatment pathway sooner than is currently the case, and with the very likely result that their whole disease experience will improve. There are a couple of drugs that we haven't been able to approve. That's because they're priced way above their clinical value. If the pharmaceutical companies that produce them offer realistic pricing to the NHS, those decisions might change in the future.
So we need the companies to bring the prices down. And finally, Paul.
I'd entirely agree. We set out to try and address inequalities in care in small areas around elite units. Some people get the sort of services that we think should be available to the whole of the NHS. That may come with a cost, and we think that improving those services is the most effective use of NHS resources.
Thank you all very much. Thanks for listening to this extra edition of our Science Weekly podcast. Remember, for information on this and other health issues, just go to theguardian.com/science. But from me, Sarah Bosley, and producer Jason Phipps, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.